Now it's time to dig into the promised series, The State of the Station. This group of broadcasts will illuminate the pioneer radio stations, most of which came on the air during the early 1920s, and see how they developed their facilities over the years. We can do that thanks to extensive records available on microfiche from the FCC through the efforts of Zen Scott, an avid radio enthusiast. Most of our old-timers know that by the 1930s, most of the big stations had settled in with their high-power systems, and except for the 1941 NARBA frequency reassignment and some minor changes resulting from the Rio treaties of 40 years later, there weren't a lot of changes or upgrades after the initial startup mayhem until the FCC opened it up again in recent years. So those stations are covered, but it was at the other lower-powered stations that most of the action occurred over the past half century. The FCC has reclassified their earlier stepped power levels, which were 1 kilowatt and then 5 and then 10 and 25 and 50, and allowed stations to operate with intermediate powers and specialized antennas for a better fit. And the result, while seemingly adding to the chaos on the band, actually went a long way toward solidifying coverage for many of those regionals and made them more predictable targets for DXers. Well, the devil is in the details, and I'm not really sure how this is going to work out for you, but we're going to try to put our toes into the water for a couple of columns and ask you to provide the feedback we'll need to keep going or stop the series. Of course, we hope the information is of interest, but if it's not, we'd like it if you'd tell us. So off we go. Not necessarily in any particular order, but finding stations here and there that we can talk about. And let's start with KTHS, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and how it seemed to be tied to the Dallas-Fort Worth market. Or to use another title, the strange switchies of 1040 and 1060. Trust me, this is going to be complicated. I'll do my best to explain a very convoluted situation involving several stations that were interweaved by fortune and poor thinking by the federal radio guys. I guess we all recall that WBAP and WFAA swapped time and frequencies in Dallas, but did you know that very early on, WBAP shared time with KTHS in Arkansas? In fact, there's a fascinating early relationship between the Dallas stations and KTHS, now KAAY. And by the way, we're going to speak in frequencies rather than wavelengths to keep this simple and consistent. WBAP and WFAA had originally been licensed for 630 kilocycles. Within a few months, they had been moved to 600 sharing time. It turned out to be an on-again, off-again relationship. Late in 1928, WBAP moved to 800 with 5 kilowatts. And now, WBAP was sharing time with KTHS, which had moved from 780 to 800. Now, KRLD Dallas, after flirting with 890, had come on the air on 650 in mid-1927. They were sharing time with WRR Dallas. KRLD was moved to 1040 in early 1928. Well, the plot grows more confusing, folks. WFAA had gone from 630 to 600 to 550, and in 1928 was told to move to 1040. But there they would have to timeshare that channel with KRLD. This early frequency shuffling is very typical of the reports, as you'll hear in coming months. In the early days, particularly in the first 2 or 3 years of operation, and up until about 1930, it wasn't unusual for stations to be on 4 or 5 different frequencies, to the detriment of the listeners, of course. Then in early 1929, KTHS also moved to 1040, where it now shared time with KRLD and WFAA. While KTHS was at 10 kilowatts, WFAA had been given a permit to build out 50 kilowatts to attain parity with WBAP. So in 1929, we had KTHS and KRLD WFAA together on 1040. WFAA went to 800 and thus began its long-time sharing arrangement with WBAP. More on that in just a minute. So back to our story. We had WFAA and WBAP on 800, and now KTHS and KRLD sharing 1040. And all was fine, and the listeners could finally find their programs. Not. The FCC file shows that KTHS was granted an unusual variance in 1929, permission to move to 970 temporarily during the World Series games. Presumably, they would have otherwise had to yield the channel to KRLD during game times. KTHS, over the following years, seemed to have a love affair with 970. They requested the frequency for other special broadcasts. One that stands out is a request to use 970 for the Atwater Kent receiver demonstration of October 31, 1931. I couldn't make this up, folks. Well, this request was denied, but they were given the channel for daytime broadcasts on New Year's Day and were increasingly requesting 970 for special daytime hours. It was obvious the KRLD-KTHS 1040 sharing wasn't working out. KTHS received permission to operate on 1060 daytime. Interestingly, they were required to go silent on 1060 from local sunset until 8 p.m. Central Time. They solved that problem by installing one of the newly developed directional antenna systems to protect WBAL. Well, meanwhile, back in Dallas, with the KTHS change to 1060, KRLD was now able to operate full-time at 50 kilowatts on 1040. But they, too, had to install a directional antenna to protect WTIC. In the end, KTHS ended up on 1090 in 1941 and morphed into the legendary Music Station of the South, and fielded a magnificent array of rockers, as well as the iconic Beaker Street with Clyde Clifford. The call KTHS was heard until 1962, when the station began identifying as KAAY. Remember WRR Dallas? They ended up on 1310, became KAAM for a while, and are now known as KTCK. And what of WTIC and WBAL? Well, WTIC at this earlier time was on 860, but they were doing some swapping with WEEI that took them to 630 for experimental purposes, according to the record. WTIC went to 650 for a short time, then back to 630 with a stop at 560, where they shared time with WCAC. This whole thing makes me sweat. This timeshare on 560 then went to 600. While WTIC prepared an application for 50,000 watts on 1060, where they shared time with, ready, WBAL. It's almost incestuous, isn't it? Well, that didn't make much sense to either East Coast station. So in 1934, WTIC began experimental authorization on 1040, sharing, as we know, with KRLD, with both on the air full-time. The change became permanent in 1940, just a year before they had to move again to 1080. A WTIC directional antenna system was designed to protect KRLD, the reciprocal protection, but, interestingly, did not have to operate until sunset Dallas time. This unusual authorization has survived. KRLD, on the other hand, had been told to protect WTIC day and night, but that was changed to night-only directional operation. However, unlike WTIC, KRLD has to switch at local sunset, as do all other stations. WTIC was also not averse to trying new ideas. The record shows they held an authorization for operation on 660 to try synchronizing with WEAF in New York. In the mid-30s, WTIC also did some experimenting with shortwave relay systems, proving the feasibility of long-range, high-quality reception, and helping lay the groundwork for the technology for overseas news reporting via shortwave. WBAL, meanwhile, came up on 1220, moved to 1050, and in 1928 to 1060, sharing time, as we said, with WTIC. In the early 1930s, WBAL received a synchronization license, so they could operate on WJZ's frequency of 760 during the hours when 1060 was being covered by WTIC. Oh my, it was a clever way to avoid major interference along the East Coast, but it sure made it difficult for the listeners. But things were getting better. A short time later, WTIC moved to 1040. And now WBAL had to contend with KTHS in Arkansas, which had just moved to its channel. Directional antennas and the 1941 NARBA did the rest. And now, of course, WTIC and KRLD share 1080 with many other stations, while KTHS and WBAL share 1090. There was one interesting authorization that turned up in WBAL's wartime operation. We read from the FCC authorization of 1943. WBAL granted authority to operate with non-directional antenna during such periods when it is necessary to transmit air raid signals and air raid test signals, only in compliance with orders from First Fighter Command, in order to ensure maximum efficiency from WBAL as a key alerting station. That may have been the first example of nighttime operation not conforming to the regular license, which idea, we know, seems to accidentally occur on many local nighttime stations during high school sports season. And the rest, as they say, is history. The station jumping between 1040 and 1060 must have driven listeners crazy and certainly added gray hair to the DXers. And now, quickly, the conclusion of the WFAA-WBAP story. In 1932, WBAP began to operate with WFAA's transmitter. Since they were time-sharing 800, this was a piece of cake, just changed the wires. A few years later, the stations were allowed to jointly identify as WFAA-WBAP Dallas. WFAA and WBAP got 50 kilowatts in steps on 800, where they would stay until 1941 when NARBA moved them to 820. Now 570 enters the picture. Go get a glass of water and we'll continue. In 1938, WBAP had had enough of time-sharing 800 with WFAA, and its owner moved in a station on 570 from Wichita Falls. A few years later, the timeshare took on a new twist. During the time WBAP was on 820 at 50 kilowatts, WFAA operated on 570 at 5 kilowatts, and the calls switched back and forth during day parts. Although historians note that the radio networks didn't shift with the call letters. In other words, NBC stayed on the 800 or 820 spot regardless of the station call at the time, while ABC would be heard on 570, regardless of which station was operating there at the time. And then finally, in 1970, WBAP had a new owner and full-time solo operation on 820, while WFAA stayed full-time at 570. Those 570 call letters changed a few times, and 570 at one point ended up as the home of Cliff, KLIF, the legendary rocker that had been heard on the 1190 frequency. WBAP, of course, continues its powerhouse full-service programming on 820 to 35 states. And that, folks, is more than enough for our inaugural broadcast of the State of the Station series. If you made it through this one, you can easily handle the stories we're preparing for the development of others. And next month, we visit Alaska and the Pacific Northwest to learn about some of the stations that began life to serve those areas.